And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Good morning and welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. My name is Mark Gillar. Today we have a great show lined up for you. We're going to be speaking with Andrew Meehan. He is with the Coalition for a Secure Driver's License. But first up, a gentleman who is certainly no stranger to the Tea Party Power Hour. He's written a brand new book entitled Who Really Killed Kennedy? I'm talking, of course, about Dr. Jerome Corsi. Dr. Corsi, welcome back to the show.
Mark, great to be back with you. Thank you.
You've just written this book, Who Really Killed Kennedy? What sets this book apart from all the other books that have been written about the Kennedy assassination?
Well, I think I go back in the, I go back to the 1950s. My dad was a labor union lobbyist, Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen, and I spent a lot of time in Washington, going back to the 50s with the McClellan Committee hearings when I was a kid, 1957, and that was really the start of Jack Kennedy's public career. The key witnesses at that hearing to start it off. Those were the hearings about the Teamsters being penetrated by the mob. Jimmy Hoffa, that was the beginning of the Jimmy Hoffa feud with Kennedy. The key witnesses were the Elkins family. I spent a lot of time with the Elkins family. I know the inside story. It's not just having researched it for 50 years, which I've done, but for instance, the Elkins family is one of the group that came to Jack Kennedy in the Oval Office and told Jack that there was an assassination plot and he was likely to be killed. The setup was going to be a high-powered rifle with a scope and a shooter from a tall building during a motorcade. And even the day Jack Kennedy died, on November 22, 1963, when he woke up that day in Fort Worth, Texas, he was talking about how easy it would be to kill him in the motorcade that afternoon or that morning. And it was on Kennedy's mind because there had been two prior attempts to kill Kennedy in November 1963 that people know very little about, the one in Chicago and another one in Tampa. So, again, I'm able to go into the story and explain things and really produce information and analyses that most people don't know anything about at this point.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is how Kennedy almost became obsessed with death in his final months. He was very much into a particular poem about death, and he talked about it frequently. Do you think that Kennedy felt his assassination was inevitable, or was this perhaps a product of the fact that he was actually a very sickly man on a lot of medications?
Well, Kennedy had his whole life he had a preoccupation with death. It did intensify, but, you got to remember Jack Kennedy as a child had a lot of illnesses. He was close to death a number of times. In fact, in 1954, I believe it was, he had to be taken out of his Senate office in a stretcher. He had to have a back operation that just about killed him. World War II, his boat got run over by a Japanese destroyer. He had to swim save the other guys and swim to a nearby island to save them. But Jack Kennedy faced death many times, and he had a preoccupation that he was going to die young. There was an element of the pain. He had Addison's disease, which is an adrenal deficiency, very dangerous. He had a congenital back ailment. It was not a football injury like the family said. And in fact, he had to wear a back brace. He was wearing a back brace, a very big ace bandage brace that covered his upper torso. His torso was to his waist. When he died that day, November 22, 1963, you can see the torso brace that Kennedy was wearing. It's in the exhibits for the Warren Commission. So at any rate, then when the plots began to assassinate him, and Kennedy knew the risks he was running being in a motorcade. Of course, that was part of being a politician in the 60s. You had to be public to run for office, and certainly for the president. He couldn't hide behind the bubble top and expect to win. So, Kennedy, I think, always had a fate. He felt his fate was going to be to die young. And truthfully, I don't think he wanted to live to be old. incapacitated, in a wheelchair. That was not Jack Kennedy's idea of life.
This book claims to reveal evidence that has never before been revealed. Can you just sort of take those in a piecemeal fashion and go down the list and talk to us about some of the stuff that you're including in this book that previously has not been released?
Well, there's lots of information here. I mean, the whole discussion of the two plots to kill Kennedy, I mean, they're in the public record, but they're very difficult for people. Most people know nothing about the assassination attempts in Chicago and Tampa the same month, November 63. I'm bringing forward evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald was an agent of the FBI and worked with the CIA as a defector who was planned to defect, still loyal to the United States, but a Marine who was recruited to help penetrate the KGB in Russia. Even the the Warren Commission knew, I cite some memos that have recently been released from Lee Rankin, who was the chief counsel, where the Warren Commission knew that Lee Harvey Oswald was a FBI agent being paid $200 a month to be a source to the FBI, and he was on the payroll. And also, Lee Harvey Oswald had a CIA number, a CIA file that built ultimately into 50,000 pages, and it was maintained by James Angleton, who was tracking these Marines and other soldiers who defected as double agents, working loyally with the United States. Oswald was among that group. So most people don't recognize that the commission discussed this evidence, and Alan Dulles, the former head of the CIA, who was also on the Warren Commission, and I say was one of the major cover-up artists, I say Alan Dulles was a mastermind of the plot to kill Kennedy. The commission decided to suppress this information and represent Oswald as a lone gun, dissatisfied assassin, which is just not the case. I think Oswald was an agent and was working in a double agent capacity with both the FBI and the CIA, and the government knew this at the time of the assassination and also knew that Oswald had nothing to do with it. Oswald was on the second floor of the Texas School Book Depository. That's where he was found immediately after the shooting, in the lunchroom, drinking a Coke. I don't even think Oswald was on the sixth floor when the shooting happened.
You talk about the fact that Kennedy had a lot of enemies, and you mentioned, for example, that Nixon knew about the assassination plot, LBJ knew about the assassination plot, the mob was involved, the CIA was involved. It seems like, I know politics makes for strange bedfellows, and there's that old saying, my enemy's enemy is my friend, and so forth, but it seems like an unlikely group to come together and seamlessly pull off an assassination. How are they able to pull this off?
Well, first of all, the CIA and the mob had been working together virtually from the founding of the CIA. The OSS, which was the predecessor to the CIA in World War II, had freed Lucky Luciano, who was the top mobster in New York, to go back to Sicily to get the Sicilian mafia to work with the U.S. Army and with Patton in the invasion of Sicily. And so the pacts between the mafia and the and in fact, at the time JFK was killed, Bobby Kennedy was working with the mob to get hit people to go into Cuba to kill Castro. And so the mob and CIA have worked together on drugs, going back to virtually every war, certainly since World War II.
Now, when you say work together on drugs, what does that mean?
Well, I pointed out that, in the book, that one of the assassins who was found in Dallas as a Corsican assassin had been part of the team, if you remember the movie Day of the Jackal, part of the groups that were trying to kill Charles de Gaulle. He was working with the drug lords in Vietnam, and the Army, the U.S. military, and the CIA were involved in the drug trade and in promoting it out of Vietnam and into Marseille, part of the French Connection, if you remember the movie The French Connection. That was all about the... And, in fact, the assassin who was in Dallas was part of that drug team assassin, very famous international assassin. He was picked up in Dallas the day Kennedy died and let go a couple days later by the Immigration Naturalization Service, never investigated. I'm sure he was there to participate in the assassination. The CIA wanted to go into Vietnam. Jack Kennedy would not fight these lying Vietnam, these lying wars that the CIA wanted to fight. Jack Kennedy wouldn't. He felt tricked by Dulles. Alan Dulles had in the Bay of Pigs calculated the invasion would fail and that Kennedy would be embarrassed. Kennedy would launch a airstrike from a naval carrier and in order to save the invasion, save the embarrassment. Kennedy refused to do it. Kennedy was not going to fight in Laos. He was not going to fight in Vietnam. And Kennedy was really the first victim of this emerging new world order that Alan Dulles and, you know, the Bush family had participated in going back to before World War II. And then when Kennedy would not fight these wars, including not fighting for them for the CIA involvement in the drug trade, I mean, people got to remember and ask yourself, you know, why is it today we get more heroin being exported from Afghanistan than when the Taliban was running Afghanistan? And the answer is CIA and the military, mostly the CIA involved in the drug trade, including today in Afghanistan.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, Afghanistan is the number one supplier of heroin to the United States.
It is. And it replaced Southeast Asia, which was the main supplier of heroin during the 60s. And, you know, for a while there, Colombia was involved, but Colombia's always been more cocaine than anything else. So the drug trades and the CIA, I mean, if you think about it for a minute, how does all these drugs and all the money in the drug trade pass international boundaries? Of course the CIA is involved in it. The CIA participates and makes money on the drug trade and has always done so, working with the mafia and the CIA hand in hand. You know, we are the drug trade, always have been. We blame it on the Mexican cartels, but you don't think the Mexican cartels are operating without CIA knowledge. I mean, it's all part of the underground story of the politics that rarely gets surfaced for most Americans. But I go back to the New World Order. I point out in the book that the Dulleses, Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, fired by Jack Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs, and his brother John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State under Eisenhower, were working with Brown Brothers Harriman before World War II to finance Hitler. We financed Hitler. Wall Street financed Hitler. And the Bushes, the two patriarchs of the Bush family, George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush, were also both members of the Harriman Brothers firm, and they were going right along with the Dulleses in financing Hitler. In fact, we had a Nazi bank in New York called Union Bank that Franklin Roosevelt closed down right after Pearl Harbor, and it was being run by the Dulleses and by the Bushes for Hitler in the United States.
Well, you know, just listening to you makes me recall the title of some of these books who say that, you know, suggest that everything you've ever been taught in your history class is wrong. And it almost makes one feel that it's futile to vote, it's futile to get involved in politics, because there's so much going on behind the scenes that we just don't know about, and most of us are just kind of pawns in the grand scheme of things. I mean, as someone who really has some insight into what goes on behind the scenes, how do you feel as an individual? Do you feel helpless? Do you feel it's too big to challenge? What are your personal thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's also why I like Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was not going to go along with this agenda. He wasn't going to fight a lying Vietnam War, or he wasn't going to fight a lying CIA war. And you're right, I mean, today, no surprise, no weapons of mass destruction found with Saddam Hussein, or here you've got Secretary of State John Kerry saying Assad is the one responsible for the chemical attacks in Syria, and he's got CIA information that proves it, but you can't see it. The UN says it wasn't Assad, but the rebels. Well, I mean, this is just more CIA lying wars, fighting a war in the Middle East that's not in U.S. national interest. We have all the oil we need. Truly, we develop the Keystone Pipeline and do you know, this fractional drilling. Mm-hmm. We could be a net exporter of oil, and yet it's in Saudi Arabia's interest. Well, Jack Kennedy was not going to go along with his agenda. He said he didn't want to deal with it. He wasn't going to go along with it. And why I continue to write about it, why I continue to support the Tea Party, is the Tea Party, I think, is also saying that these globalist, internationalist entities, including the CIA, all the way up through the International Monetary Fund, the UN, all these groups are not what our founding fathers intended. Not the individual liberty and the, you know, the true national security interests of the United States being the only reason we fight wars, the Constitution. And I think the more people learn about this behind the scenes, the most they know, more they know about, you know, the reality of what has gone on in our politics with the CIA and, you know, the drug lords and the mob, the more likely it is that Tea Party groups can succeed in taking back America from these multinationals, these big government interests, Republican and Democratic. And we need to do this. We need to fight this battle. Otherwise, we lose the Constitution once and for all.
When you look back to the elections of 2010, it seemed like the Tea Party was this group that was going to be successful in taking back America. And then you get to the 2012 elections, and Barack Obama gains re-election, gains a second term. What are your thoughts for the upcoming elections? I mean, is the Tea Party going to continue to have diminishing marginal returns in terms of success in elections, or do you think the Tea Party will get it back together again, revitalized, and actually take back America from the elitist, as you've said?
Well, I wrote a book called What Went Wrong on the Election. Now, I traveled for 3 weeks with Romney, and the fact is the Democrats have really gotten down this interest group politics. They, you know the groups that they want, and they are appealing to their needs, African-Americans, Hispanics, single women. You know, they know what each of these groups, how to talk to them and promise them the goodies they're going to get. Of course, Democrats don't ever deliver anything. The African-Americans voting 96% for Obama end up, you know, with double-digit unemployment. Detroit going bankrupt, it's something like 81-82% African-American, Obama doing nothing. Obama doesn't deliver anything for these constituencies, and eventually this interest group politics falls apart because he can't pay for it. But, you know, you can manipulate it, and you can win an election manipulating it. The Obama people were very good at it, as I pointed out in the book, brilliant at it. It doesn't mean the Tea Party should be discouraged. Long-term, what Obama's wanted to establish, Obamacare, increasing big government, increasing NSA. I mean, we've got to go back to what Jack Kennedy wanted to do. If Jack Kennedy had lived, the CIA would have been disbanded. He was not going to go forward with the Federal Reserve. He knew it was a private bank. He was wanted to break up the Federal Reserve and the CIA. He wanted to print our own money through the Treasury, which we can do, not pay these international bankers interest for our money. Federal Reserve is not part of the federal government. Right. Jack Kennedy did not want to fight in Vietnam. He didn't want to fight lying wars. He would never have had a NSA listening to all of our conversations. And we can develop and go forward again. You know, Reagan was on the right path. We can go forward. There are forces out there. Got to remember, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are basically the same party anymore. You know, it's hard to distinguish big government Republicans or Mitt Romney, Romneycare, Obamacare, who cares? It's about the same thing. But yet there are the Rand Pauls and there are the Ted Cruzes, and I think these are the future of where the Tea Party is headed. The Tea Party will continue, I think, to make major strides, especially if books like my Who Really Killed Kennedy are understood, so you can see the roots of the battle the Tea Party's got to fight today, which began in World War II. The Nazis were the original New World Order. The Dulleses did everything they could to make us into the Fourth Reich. And the NSA and a massive welfare state. Remember, the Nazis were leftists. They wanted a massive Gestapo, and they were the first to institute the Nazis in universal health care. They wanted a partnership between business and government where they could fight these bogus CIA wars and promote munitions on an international level to stimulate economic growth. We've largely taken on the Nazi objectives. And if Hitler thought he could have the EU with Germany dominating it, transatlantic partnership with the United States where we would forego our sovereignty, an NSA and a CIA that could readily provide the intelligence, international bank that could finance it, controlled by Germany and the United States, Hitler would have signed on in a minute. It was exactly what he wanted to achieve.
I think it's interesting because I'm sure you've heard liberals claim that the Nazis were all a bunch of right-wingers.
Well, it's a lie. People need to read Jonah Goldberg's Liberal Fascism. The Nazis were national socialists. They disagreed with the communists because the communists wanted to eliminate private property. The Nazis did not want to eliminate private property. They wanted to create a massive state-driven international business setting where the international businesses ruled not only Germany but across borders. And they didn't have a welfare system for the people too stupid, too poor, too old. And if anybody disagreed, the Gestapo or the NSA would pick them up and get rid of them.
Now, let me get back to your book, Who Really Killed Kennedy. And you mentioned that there is now ballistic evidence that proves that there had to be more than one shooter. Elaborate on that.
Well, when you go back to the Parkland Hospital, where Kennedy was brought immediately after the shooting, all the wounds were seen as front entry. The neck wound was seen as a puncture wound from the front. Jack Kennedy's head, the back of his head was blown away. That would have been an exit wound from the headshot.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very clear to the doctors at the hospital that Jack Kennedy had been shot from the front.
Yes.
And, of course, the back wound was, even at Bethesda, only about a quarter of an inch penetrating into Jack Kennedy's body, more like a .22 wound. And yet the single bullet theory on which the entire Warren Commission idea that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole shooter is based, there never was a path established from the wound in the back of Jack Kennedy to his neck medically, because the doctors at Bethesda did not think that the two could ever be connected. It was Arnold Spector, a counsel, who created the single bullet theory, because otherwise, with one shot missing and hitting a bystander, James Tague, there were four shots at least. Otherwise, unless one bullet wounded both JFK in his neck and back and John Connolly, with the bullet passing through Kennedy and hitting Connolly. So you had to eliminate one shot. The shot that missed had to be explained. Otherwise, four shots were too many to fire in the time frame of 5.7 seconds that Lee Harvey Oswald had to work this bolt-action manual Mannlicher-Carcinol rifle, where each round had to be separately chambered into the weapon by a bolt-action that you had to manually work.
By the way, speaking of John Connolly, whenever the shots rang out, did he not state, "Oh my God, they're going to shoot us all"?
Yes, and in fact, Connolly said that he thought that the shot that hit him was a different shot than hit Jack Kennedy. And he insisted on that till the day he died. And Connolly knew weapons. He was a sportsman. He knew gunfire. And if Connolly insisted he was hit by a second shot, and he kind of justified it by the Zapruder film, showed you where he thought he was hit. But even before the Zapruder film was watched or seen by anybody, he had an interview in the hospital immediately after the assassination with John Connolly, and he even then said he was hit by a separate shot. Separate shot hitting John Connolly meant two shooters, just as a front entry wound meant two shooters. Because Texas School Book Depository was behind the limousine when the shooting started.
Again, when you watch that scene in slow motion of the back of John F. Kennedy's head coming off, and I think most people remember Jacqueline Kennedy climbing onto the back of the car to retrieve that, a very emotional scene. And no matter how many times I watch it, it seems pretty obvious that that's an exit wound. I mean, if anybody knows anything about how a bullet goes through a body and how the exit wound is large, you know, typically much bigger than the entry wound, it's just obvious that that shot didn't come from behind.
Well, and also, Mark, the very rarely watched end of the Zapruder film, last frames as the car is going under the triple underpass. I mentioned this in Who Really Killed Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy gets back in the car. She's trying to pick up the pieces of her husband's brain and skull. And the immediate impulse is to try to put it all back in and everything will be okay. Like if you break an arm or whatever, you want to put the bone back together and everything will be okay. Well, it doesn't work. But she had, Jacqueline Kennedy had Jack Kennedy sitting upright with his head all put back together again when the car is going under the triple underpass. Very eerie to look at it because Jack Kennedy looks like he's perfectly fine, except he's totally dead. And you can see the back of his head is blown out. So you, there's a photographic evidence there that you have to enlarge the pictures, you have to get a good view of it, but if you do, you can see the back of Jack Kennedy's head is blown away, and that's what the doctors in Parkland said they saw.
What evidence is there that LBJ and Richard Nixon were aware that this attempt was going to take place?
Well, there's mostly, Richard Nixon stayed in Dallas. He was in Dallas the day the assassination occurred, as, by the way, was George H.W. Bush, with also photographic evidence and evidence that George Bush was working with the CIA. Nixon was there, too. Nixon didn't leave until after the assassination. Of course, Johnson was in the motorcade. I think there's a good argument made that Johnson was slouching down as the car, as his car entered Dealey Plaza, certainly on the Altgens Associated Press very famous photograph of Kennedy limousine from the front. When Kennedy has just had his neck wound, his arms are reached up to his neck, you look back and you see Lyndon Johnson's car. You can see Lady Bird very clearly, but Johnson doesn't look like he's anywhere in the picture. And clearly Johnson was the one who benefited the most. The Kennedys were going to destroy Johnson's career. Life magazine was ready to do the second expose on the Bobby Baker scandal, which certainly would have destroyed Johnson's career. And, you know, Johnson, I think it's why there were three assassination attempts to kill Jack Kennedy in November. The next article on Life was scheduled to be published the week after the Dallas trip. And it was an article that Lyndon Johnson and those supporting Lyndon Johnson didn't want published. The CIA was happy to have Lyndon Johnson. He would readily fight their lying wars in Vietnam, including going along with the Tonkin Gulf incident, which was the precipitating incident for the buildup in Vietnam and the legislation that authorized the Vietnam War, which was a totally CIA-concocted incident. There were no fishing boats in the Tonkin Gulf that attacked the Maddox from Vietnam. It was the Vietnam War was started on a pretext because the Maddox was an intelligence boat in the Tonkin Gulf spying on North Vietnam.
Speaking of LBJ, I can't help but remember a quote from Kessler's book where one of the Secret Service agents that followed him around said that if the guy hadn't been president, he probably would have been in an insane asylum somewhere. Just some of the stunts this guy pulled throughout his life, some of the things he did, kind of makes me feel like there's nothing he wouldn't do to satisfy his personal quest for power.
Lyndon Johnson was very definitely power hungry, wanted to be president. His past in Texas pretty sorted, both the Billy Saul Estes scandal and the Bobby Baker scandal should have destroyed Lyndon Johnson's career, and I think would have once the Kennedys had a chance to fully expose them, which they were in the process of doing. And there's no chance that Johnson would have been off the ticket in '64. And his career would have been ended. So I think there was very strong motivation, strong desire on Johnson's part. He was a clear beneficiary of the assassination. I think he knew about it. I think he went along with it. And I think he gave a green light, as far as he was concerned, to it happening. And then created the Warren Commission and stacked the Warren Commission along with Hoover's assistance. So so that the people on the Warren Commission would go along and the cover-up could be in full swing.
Now, I believe you mentioned in the book that J. Edgar Hoover was happy to work with LBJ.
Yeah, J. Edgar Hoover hated Kennedy and wanted LBJ, because LBJ would readily give, and he did give Hoover a lifetime appointment. And the Kennedys were not going to give Hoover a lifetime appointment to head the CIA, head the FBI. And J. Edgar Hoover had been taping the Kennedys. There was great animosity between them. And Hoover wanted the cover-up to go forward. Hoover was prime mover in making sure the investigation of the assassination all got pulled back to Washington, was not conducted in Dallas, and was conducted in a way where any information that was detrimental to the FBI or the CIA was held from the American people, including witnesses were not called who thought the shots came from the grassy knoll or had any different view of the assassination than the one that had been predetermined, namely to frame Lee Harvey Oswald as the sole shooter. Without letting the American people know that Lee Harvey Oswald was an agent who most likely defected to Russia as a counterintelligence effort by the U.S. military to penetrate the KGB. And this is all, again, information that's available, and I cite in great detail the proof of all this in the book Who Really Killed Kennedy. I have over 700 footnotes in the book, and you can see everything I'm saying is heavily documented.
Well, people are saying that this book kind of raises the bar, is, you know, because there have been literally hundreds of books written on this topic. I know you did an incredible amount of research prior to writing this book, and as you said, you've basically been researching it for decades. This isn't something you've just put together over the last few years. It certainly comes through, and I'm going to be honest, I've just really gotten into it, but even in my early reading, it's obvious that this book is extremely well documented. So at this point, I'm going to encourage my readers to go out and grab a copy of it. We're going to make it really easy for them to get a copy because we're going to put a link on our website, teapartypowerhour.com, right underneath your picture and a description of this particular broadcast. And all they'll need to do is click on it, and they'll be able to obtain a copy. Now, I've already seen it in the stores. I like to hang out in bookstores, and I know it's in all the major players as far as bookstores are concerned. Is there anything else you'd like to tell my listeners about the book before we have to go?
No, I just think, Mark, the key thing is it's really a book. It explores the Kennedy assassination, but I wrote it to try to explain why we are the way we are today. Big government, big CIA, new world order in place, fighting wars that are not in our national security interest but advanced by the CIA for other interests, other economic interests, including Saudi Arabia today in the Middle East, and how Jack Kennedy would have eliminated, you know, fundamental structures of this new world order, including the Federal Reserve, how we would have eliminated the CIA and gone back to the individual rights, not these collective rights that were fundamental to the Nazi view of the future. And I'm arguing that largely Jack Kennedy assassination, the Dulleses, the Bushes, participated in creating the New World Order, which is the Fourth Reich, and how what we face as a Tea Party is the challenge of reversing these decades of collectivist thinking, which are fundamentally leftist in their nature, as were the Nazis, but are certainly at odds with the individual freedoms that our founding fathers had. Jack Kennedy, I think, was killed because Jack Kennedy wouldn't fight the CIA's lying wars. And he did believe in the fundamental idea of individual freedom our founding fathers espoused.
As we look forward to the next presidential election, and some of us are really, really looking forward to it, do you see another Jack Kennedy anywhere on the horizon? If not this next election, but at some point in the future, someone who will fight that fight?
Well, I think Tea Party's best hopes, and certainly, you know, mine, are with people like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, who are not buying into this big party Republican idea, which is indistinguishable from what the Democrats want. I can't tell the difference between John McCain and Lindsey Graham and the Democrats anymore. John McCain was the first candidate to lose to Barack Obama, and Obamacare, Romneycare, I couldn't tell really what the difference was. And again, you know, if Republicans are going to continue to run Me Too Democrats, they're going to continue to lose. If Karl Rove remains in control of the Republican Party, it's like having another New World Order guy. Might as well have the Bush family, and the core of the Republican Party is going to change the channel and turn off, not participate. That's the whole point of my book, What Went Wrong. And my book's What Went Wrong and Who Really Killed Kennedy work hand-in-hand in that regard. If you want to understand how we've got to get back to candidates running for president who will espouse Tea Party values, and we have to make the Republican Party realize that if the Republican Party wants to be a Me Too Democratic Party, we don't need the Republican Party. We're not Republicans first. Tea Party, I think, advocates, those who really believe in the fundamental smaller government vision of our founding fathers, are not Republicans except when Republicans understand these values and will help us return to smaller government ideals in the Constitution.
Dr. Corsi, I want to thank you for being here today. It's been too long. Let's not make it so long between visits in the future. I wish you the best of luck with this new book. Once again, it is Who Really Killed Kennedy by Dr. Jerome Corsi. We're going to be putting some links up on our website, but hey, don't wait for that. Run out to your bookstore and get a copy today. Once again, Dr. Corsi, thanks for being here.
Always, Mark, my great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to the second half of the Tea Party Power Hour. My guest for this half hour is Mr. Andrew Meehan. He is the policy director for the Coalition for a Secure Driver's License. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your organization, Coalition for a Secure Driver's License, when you started, why you started, and essentially what your mission is.
So the Coalition for a Secure Driver's License was founded in 2001, shortly after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. The idea was that driver's licenses represent an integral part of how we move in and out of the United States. We use them to open bank accounts, sign leases, in some cases purchase alcohol, for a whole host of purposes. They've become the de facto preferred form of identity in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, driver's licenses were issued with very low standards. You know, to get a valid government-issued ID with someone else's name on it was very easy. And after 9/11, a lot of DMVs and motor vehicle agencies started to think about how we can best secure the driver's license. How can we prevent identity theft and fraud? So part of our core mission, really, is to try to explain that to the public, why it's important, how it affects your identity, and then to further, you know, explain to state legislators when they have questions about why it's necessary to do certain things, what documents verify what parts of your identity, and why it's important to have a layered system.
Well, hang on a second. Before you go any farther with that, I graduated high school in 1981, and what I remember from that time, Andrew, is that just about every teenage-oriented magazine had a section in the back where you had your choice of numerous companies where you could order a fake driver's license, but they really did look fake. I'm in Texas right now. I was raised in Texas, and I can tell you the driver's license that they were offering for Texas looked like a joke. It didn't look anything like our actual driver's license. Maybe that's how they protected themselves legally, the people making these. But we've gone away from those little fake kiddie licenses in the back of those Tiger Beat magazine or whatever magazine it might have been to some pretty sophisticated operations, have we not?
That's true. That is very true. Motor vehicle agencies are probably at the forefront of identity management technology. You know, these are the guys that have to deal with, you know, on the one end, getting you in and out of the DMV as quickly as possible. On the other hand, making sure you are who you say you are. And there are a lot of bad guys out there that would love to assume someone else's identity or create another identity to avoid detection. And as such, things like card security, you know, the actual physical card itself has improved. We're using more different, newer methods of fraud detection, looking at the documents that you're presenting and saying, I don't know if that looks fake. I better call the agency that issued it and make sure that this is a valid document. You know, a lot, the methodology, the scrutiny that we're applying over the documents that we're accepting has increased dramatically, especially over the last 10 years.
Andrew, if I were a terrorist from some other part of the world and I wanted to come to the United States and do horrible things to Americans, what is the first phony document that I have to get? Is it a driver's license, a birth certificate, a... Yeah, where do I start, and how important is this driver's license in that chain of events?
Unfortunately, not the first one to come up with this idea. Khalid Al-Dasari, who was a student in Texas, actually, came up with it on his own that if he were to make a counterfeit birth certificate, that would open the door to a number of identity documents, including a U.S. passport and a driver's license.
Gotcha.
Now, the scary thing about this guy is that, one, he's a Saudi national, and he's not from the United States, so he's not someone who has been ingrained in U.S. culture or who understands, you know, kind of ins and outs of going to the DMZ. Two, he was a lone wolf terrorist, so he's one of the guys that doesn't communicate with anybody, that's inspired to carry out attacks, perhaps some of the most dangerous. And thirdly was that he arrived at the birth certificate on his own, completely... You know, he figured it out. It wasn't great. Now, granted, the guy was an engineering student, so there was some intelligence there, obviously, and there was some coordination in the attack. So he's obviously very capable, but he arrived at this conclusion himself without being somebody who's in the industry or who's in law enforcement or who had any prior training. And that, for us at CSDL, is probably the scariest thing. The birth certificate is a virtual gateway to people's identities. They're issued by 6,000 different entities with 14,000 different types. Even if I was looking at a valid or counterfeit birth certificate, it would be near impossible for me to confirm that without calling the issuing agency. And I can use that birth certificate to obtain a driver's license and then obtain a Social Security number, to obtain a U.S. passport. The list continues.
Well, listen, you don't have to tell me how hard it is to verify the authenticity of a birth certificate, but that's a whole other show. Wanted to let you know that one of the problems we see, given that birth certificates are what Mike Zullo in Arizona has called the breeder document that allows you to get all the other documents, is that in the state of Hawaii, if you have two people who are residents of Hawaii, not citizens of the United States, merely residents of Hawaii, and they have a baby overseas, if they can show that they were residents of Hawaii, I think within a year of that birth, they are able to get a Hawaiian birth certificate for that child. Now, the state of Hawaii goes, but we actually put the country they were born in on the birth certificate. But you know and I know, Andrew, that if somebody takes a Hawaiian birth certificate, even if it says born in Zimbabwe on it, into a Department of Motor Vehicles to get a driver's license, they're going to be able to get one. If somebody says, well, it says there you were born in Zimbabwe. Well, yeah, but my parents were American. I was born while they were on vacation. So they put the place of birth, but I'm an American. I have a Hawaiian birth certificate because my parents were U.S. citizens living in Hawaii.
Sure.
No person at the DMV is going to say, hey, wait a minute, and get out their magnifying glass and become Sherlock Holmes and look into that. I mean, come on. We're talking about, you know, bureaucratic robots being paid by the hour. They're going to go, okay, sure, whatever. And it's actually interesting that the government doesn't want Arizona enforcing immigration law because they say no state should have the power to have its own immigration policy. But in Hawaii, they're handing out birth certificates left and right to people who are mere residents who had children overseas. So that's part of the problem. I mean, if I were a terrorist, my first stop, you know, probably would have been Puerto Rico before they cleaned things up there. And now
sure. It would
be Hawaii. So, you know, I guess my question for you is, if somebody walked into a DMV with a Hawaiian birth certificate, regardless of what the place of birth was, do you think they could get a driver's license?
I do. Now, there are a couple of laws in place that you should be aware of. One is, in 2004, Congress enacted the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act. Within that, it said that the Department of Health and Human Standards, had to set standards for birth certificates. Birth certificates are not necessarily a record of somebody's birth, but they allow HHS to track, for example, you know, it's a vital record, it's a dumping house, you know, so they're able to track, you know, certificate of death across the country, which allow them to track epidemic, diseases, you know, a whole host of public health and public safety related issues.
Gotcha.
But the 9/11 Commission had identified that the birth certificate has become this, you know, easily obtainable, very integral part of our identity. And that given that we rely on certain documents to gain access to sensitive areas, namely an airplane, that we should set standards for these documents. Now, in its infinite wisdom, the Department of Health and Human Services has yet to issue those standards, and therefore the states have not moved as aggressively as we would like to increase the security of birth certificates. Now, that's speaking very generally, but many states have moved to digitize their records, provide connectivity between other systems so that they can talk to each other and say, yeah, John Doe, born on this date in this hospital, is actually that person, and the document number on the birth certificate that you're seeing is a valid one. Other states are called open record states. Anybody can walk in and for a small fee obtain a birth certificate. We spoke to a legislator in a state, I don't say which one, but he had worked for the Navy Intelligence, and one of the things that they had looked at was how easy it was to gain multiple identities with birth certificates. And sure enough, he was able to obtain 6 different driver's licenses with the same picture, 6 different identities.
Wow.
And that, to us, is a very, very big risk. Well, the other act that was passed in 2005 was the Real ID Act. And this is not a very popular piece of legislation, frankly, because it suffers from a lot of myths out there about what it really does. But it said that, listen, if you want to use a driver's license to board an airplane, a federally operated space, that driver's license has to meet certain standards. The federal government has to have confidence that the document is who they say they are, and this is it. Now, most of the states, following the enactment of Real ID, moved aggressively. They started doing immigration checks for applicants who apply for a driver's license. They started tying the term of the license to the term of an individual's authorized period of stay. So if I'm an immigrant and I'm here for 3 years, my driver's license is only good for 3 years. They started increasing the card security. They were running background checks on DMV employees who might have access to copies of your birth certificate. Secretary Napolitano had tried to repeal this act unsuccessfully, and so kind of its implementation has suffered from a number of things, but the states are moving very aggressively. Over 20 states are currently compliant with its standards, and you know, there's still some of those languishing, but they are moving forward.
Well, I was about to ask you, if the birth certificate was the breeder document, then why you're not called the Coalition for Secure Birth Certificate, but it's obvious that they're not using their birth certificates to get on planes and blow things up. They're using a driver's license that they got with the fake birth certificate.
Right. It's important to understand that the driver's license is unique because of the photo. A birth certificate is used to gain these valid photo IDs, but the photo itself, the fact that there's a valid government ID document with a photo, really the validation that many of the criminals and fraudsters are going to seek. They're going to say, hey, there's my photo, and that's the name, so that must be it. And that's really why it is kind of such an integral document. You know, you can walk into any liquor store, nobody's going to say, oh, I see your birth certificate.
Right.
I see your driver's license.
Gotcha. Well, that's a very valid point. And one of the things, though, if we go back to the root cause again, and this is someone getting the fake birth certificate first, one of the things that needs to be put in place is a way for people to verify birth certificates. And I cannot stand the way hospitals, particularly one in Hawaii, hides behind the HIPAA law to say that they can't state whether somebody was born there or not. I've actually read the HIPAA law. The HIPAA law was initially put in place to prevent insurance companies and large medical companies from wholesaling large amounts of medical information to people that wanted to sell things to particular groups. For instance, if you sold diabetes meters or catheters or foot where for diabetics, you might go to an insurance company and say, I'd like to buy a mailing list of 1 million diabetics. And that type of thing was clearly wrong. It was clearly a violation of policy. And not knowing what HIPAA meant, the hospitals and doctors' offices have gone nuts with this thing. I mean, you walk into an office, they'll only call you back by your first name because they're afraid of violating HIPAA. They've got the little sign-in sheets with the rollers on them, so they roll your name back after you sign in. I mean, it was never meant to be any of that, but one of the things that needs to happen is legislation that says hospitals must be required to verify birth certificates. And, you know, until we get that, we're never going to know if a particular birth certificate is real or if it isn't. Some hospitals keep records forever, and some hospitals say they destroy them after 25 years. Well, the lifespan of an individual is much longer than 25 years, and 25 years just doesn't cut it. So I think it's time for hospitals to stop hiding behind the HIPAA law, which doesn't even apply to this situation, and start requiring, and the government needs to start requiring hospitals to verify birth certificates. That needs to be part of their job. Hey, let them charge a nice fee for it. They can even make a profit. I don't care. But until we have hospitals willing to verify birth certificates, and I'm not saying reported births or, you know, an affidavit filed 30 years after the birth, but an actual birth certificate from the date of birth, until hospitals are willing to do that, we're going to continue to have these situations where people make up fake birth certificates and then use it as a breeder document to get driver's licenses and other photo IDs. So anyway, I've thrown my two cents in. Now, one of the things, Andrew, is you talk about how some states have taken steps for a more secure driver's license. Tell us where those victories have taken place, what those steps are that they're putting in place, and how people can join your organization or participate with your organization in encouraging more states to do this.
So we always encourage people to visit the website, www.secure-license.org. We update it almost hourly with new stories. Obviously, we welcome donations and very much appreciate that. Some of the victories that we talk about, you know, one of the trends that we're seeing in the United States now is the issuance of what are called two-tier driver's licenses. And these are driver's licenses like we've seen in California that are provided for people who are unwilling or cannot provide proof of lawful status or lawful presence, that is, that they are likely in this country legally. And one of the things that we have tried to encourage state legislators to do is say, listen, you know, this is a very big risk. You know, you're being forced to accept documents here that are very difficult to identify. In almost all these pieces of legislation, what they are accepting what's called the matricula consular card, which is a document issued by an embassy in the event. So, for example, if I were to travel to Paris, France, and I registered with the embassy, they would give me a consular identification card. And that's really just to register with them and let them know that I'm there. What has happened, and this happened with the Mexican government, is that they've issued these things as a way of providing identification in the United States. And that is a very big problem because one, they're very easily obtainable. The FBI has testified in front of Congress. The Government Accountability Office, the investigative arm, has said that it's very easy to obtain these things. You can fill out a survey, pay $25, and walk out the door with one. They're very easily to fraudulently obtain. They're very easy to counterfeit, and they're impossible to verify. So, you know, when you accept these things, you lower the standard of identity proofing such that it makes it very easy for anybody to obtain what's called a second-tier license. Now, many states have taken steps towards that and have said, okay, we're going to put on here that it's not for identification purposes, and we're going to make it physically distinguishable. But some states have it. The District of Columbia recently passed legislation that allowed a regular driver's license be the same as a driver's license issued to an illegal alien. So what you have here is a potential mess with, you know, folks who might have suspended or revoked driver's licenses in Maryland or in Virginia coming to the district and trying to obtain a brand new license under a different identity. You have folks who may want to steal someone's identity and using kind of a permissive method here to take advantage of that. You have a lot of, like, potential risks here, not only for, you know, highway safety, but also for, you know, now creeping into the homeland security space. So what we try and do, again, is, you know, we try and work with state legislators to make sure that they understand that, you know, there are a lot of risks that you're assuming when you do that. You know, you're going to create chaos at the DMV. You may create a magnet state situation where you have large migrations of people coming to your state to obtain a driver's license, as was the case in Maryland, state of New Mexico. You know, you should be very careful of that and very wary. And we've had some victories in doing that and trying to explain that, you know, this is just not worth the risk. And a lot of the arguments that are being made are not really supported by the research. You know, folks say that, you know, highway safety will be increased if you can license people to drive. The California Department of Transportation says that for unlicensed drivers, the best thing to do is increase penalties, not necessarily license the unlicensed. AAA, along the same comments, that increasing penalties would have a much more beneficial effect than issuing large numbers of licenses. You know, there's the insurance question where people are going to say, well, there's a likelihood that they'll get insured. According to the University of New Mexico, when Bill Richardson, governor of New Mexico, enacted his driver's licenses for illegal aliens bill, the number of uninsured actually went up by 2%. Didn't decrease. You know, there's a lot of research that counteracts a lot of these arguments, and you don't often hear it. So what we try and do is kind of bring that to light and, you know, show that, okay, you have a lot of risks to identity theft and fraud, on top of which a lot of things that people here are saying don't really hold water.
Andrew, how do the laws in the United States and, you know, the various ways that we deal with driver's licenses on a state-by-state basis compare with what's done in other countries?
You're talking about apples and oranges here. Most advanced countries have national ID cards. This isn't even an issue. The government of New Mexico has a biometrically verified voter ID card issued by an independent commission so as to prevent any counterfeit or any corruption whatsoever. The French, British, you know, most of these countries have national ID cards that make it much more difficult because there's a central system for verifying identities and reviewing source documents. They also don't have the same culture that the DMVs have to deal with, where you have kind of an air of customer service and what's typically been treated as a revenue source for many state treasuries.
Mm-hmm.
And if you kind of look at the way things are budgeted, when DMVs collect fees, those fees almost always go into the general revenue of the state. They almost never are retained by the DMV, and states see them as a potential for, you know, funding various things, from highways to a whole host of programs. But other countries have very strict laws. I think the best comparison would be the U.S. passport. Passport fraud in this country is prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And if you do something wrong with a passport or alter it, you're subject to a Title 18 penalty, which catches the attention of the U.S. Attorney's Office. And that's obviously something that you don't really want. So when you see passport fraud, people go away for a long time.
Not always the
case with driver's license fraud.
Why do you think we're so lax in the United States?
I think it's really been a function of, one, the customer service piece. You know, people want their driver's licenses immediately. Nobody really likes to. Nobody's ever said, I've never heard in all of our travel that, you know, I had a really good time at the DMV the other day. You know, it's become this function of convenience and customer service. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, security takes kind of a backseat to those priorities. Now, that's changing. People become more familiar with some of the risks out there and associated with driver's license fraud. But, you know, obviously we at CFDL would hope that that would move a bit more aggressively.
And how many states would you say have taken steps to be more aggressive to the point where you and your cohorts at the Coalition for Secure Driver's License feel that the states are where they should be in terms of security?
Well, according to the Department of Homeland Security, 20 states are compliant with the Real ID Act. We would argue that probably the majority of the states, maybe 60% of all the states issuing driver's licenses, are doing a pretty reasonable job at verifying the identity of an applicant. Unfortunately, it's that 40% that kind of makes that good quality of security kind of nil. Because many states, unfortunately, accept out-of-state driver's licenses as proof of identity. So it becomes kind of an interrelated mess.
Well, if your organization could have its druthers and wave a magic wand and fix the issue, how would you do it? Does it have to be done through a federal law, I suppose?
I don't think a federal law is necessary. I think that, you know, where we were right after 9/11 was a pretty bad place as far as driver's license security goes. And the Real ID Act certainly played an integral role in moving the states ahead. But there's nothing to stop the states really from making the message to their constituents that this needs to be done. What Real ID has kind of shown us is that states are forced to explain why they're doing new things. So they're going to say, you know, you're not going to be able to get your license anymore over the counter because we've seen many cases of residency fraud. And we find that if we mail you the license that you put the address on, that there's a high likelihood that you live there. You know, they are now forced to kind of communicate to the public that these security upgrades are necessary, they protect them, and that ultimately they're going to be better off. You know, we've seen these kinds of campaigns in Florida, Delaware, Ohio. You know, these are very different states with very different demographics, and people tend to get the message and ultimately appreciate it. Same thing in West Virginia. You know, there are difficult constituencies out there. Folks, you know, there's always going to be the World War II veteran who doesn't have a birth certificate. The state deal with that. They have exceptions process. In the state of Minnesota, for example, they have something called the 39. They take you into a separate room and they ask you 39 different questions about your identity. I went through this and I couldn't remember the term of my student loan. I just assumed that it was forever, and they apparently had different ideas. But it's a very thorough process, and they make sure that they can verify that you are who you say you are. So the states are always willing to work with you. There's always, you know, a way to facilitate the security. But I don't think a federal law would have necessarily been is necessary. I think the states could do it on their own if they were willing to go in front of the public and be forthcoming about the benefits of doing a lot of this stuff.
Well, as far as, you know, the driver's license thing being a bigger inconvenience, I mean, in a lot of ways it would be hard to be more of an inconvenience than it is now. And I'm one of those people that, you know, I don't mind inconveniences when they're exchanged for extra security. You know, when I get that call from my credit card company and they say, hey, you know, someone just tried to make this purchase, was that you? Because it was kind of an unusual purchase. And I say, well, actually, that was me. And they're saying, well, you've never purchased 40 goats before. And I go, I know. But the bottom line is that I always tell them, they always say, oh, I apologize for any inconvenience. We apologize. And I always tell them, don't apologize. You're trying to keep my card safe. Same thing with airports. I'm the one person who never gripes about all the hoops one has to jump through to go through airport security. I like that. So I think when the American people realize that this is just additional security and something that can help stop terrorists who are trying to do bad things to us, I would hope that they wouldn't complain about it. But your organization is doing some great things. Obviously, it takes money to run an organization like this. Tell the folks at home how they can get involved in helping your organization through donations.
We'd love if you visit our website, www.secure-license.org. There's a donate button there. You know, we accept all donations. Anything you give can help. We have a really important kids program where we encourage kids to get their names in the system so that they don't have their identity stolen, called our Keeping Identity Safe for Kids program. So we encourage people to visit the website and have a look. And if you have any questions, please give us a call, 202-312-1540.
Okay, well, we're going to post that link to your website on our homepage. And Andrew, I just want to thank you for being here. Once again, Andrew Meehan, who is the policy director for the Coalition for a Secure Driver's License. Andrew, thanks for being here. It was great having you on the air.
Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillard.